from the home of hashtag MTOS, the movie talk on Sundays, comes Film File, the podcast. Follow us on Twitter at Filmfile UK.
And here we are back with episode 2 of The Film File. I'm Lee Ford.
I'm Andy Meakin.
And we've got more news, reviews, and bits and pieces from around the World Wide Web to entertain you for the next, 50 minutes to an hour or so. We'll see how it goes. A bit of housekeeping first. Thank you to all those who listened last time. Andy, I do believe we're now on iTunes.
iTunes has been a nightmare to get fed through. So I've managed to piggyback the old feed from the old podcast that I used to do with a few of the guys. So if you just do a search on iTunes for Film File, you will find us. Go into the iTunes tracker list. It's just Film File. Can't miss it.
And we're on Spotify as well.
We're on Spotify. A lot easier to find on there. Again, just put Film File in and we're the only one there. Very easy to spot. The logo is quite distinctive. Check that out. And also, we're on SoundCloud, which is where most of them are getting uploaded to and streamed to it initially.
Fantastic. What we'd like you to do is tell your friends, tell your auntie, your uncle, your grandma, your granddad. Stop people in the street.
Tell your cats and dogs. I've heard that cats and dogs love my voice.
Yes, I've seen my cat now. We're recording this at my house. My cat is desperately trying to get into the house, drawn uniquely and strangely and mystifyingly to Andy's voice. We don't know why. But if you can, leave us a review on iTunes. It's good for us. Hopefully we'll get some sponsorship. We've got some interesting ideas what we'd like to do with the show further down the line. But today we've been joined by a guest, and we'd like to introduce yourself, dear guest.
Oh, I'm terrible at introductions.
I'll just tell who you are.
I'm Scott. I am Andy's friend, partner.
Hello.
Can I say partner?
I've known Andy a long time, and this is a side to him that he's going to be interesting.
Second episode in, I've just been out of
it. Had to come out somehow. I work with Andy. I've known him quite a few years.
And he was one of my partners on the previous podcasts, which you can find the remnants of on if you search for it on iTunes.
It's all come strangely full circle. So as we do, we've got the housekeeping out of the way. As we do, we'd like to talk about stuff that we've seen on the web that's interesting to us and other film freaks along the lines. Andy, what have we got?
Well, let's start small, shall we? Let's start with the Bond 25 title.
Fantastic.
No Time to Die. Thoughts on the title?
I think it's a cool Bond title. I think it does what a Bond title needs to do. I think it's interesting to maybe, and I'm reading between the lines on this, and there may be even no lines to read between, but I do think it's got that feel of a classic Fleming title. But I also think it might be an indication that this is Daniel Craig's last movie and what they're going to do with it after this. Who knows?
Yeah, that's fair. My favourite Bond titles are always the ones that sound like you probably use them in everyday parlance, but you just don't.
I can't. Diamonds Are Forever. Live, Let Die.
You put right in the Thunderball.
You put like 5 or 6 cool sounding spy words into a blender and then it pops out a little. So you get a catchphrase and you go, that's a Bond title.
I know there's a little meme going around at the moment, which is you use your month of birth and your date of birth to work out what your Bond title is. And mine ended up like being Tomorrow Never Goldfingers.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, I think
to watch.
I think that's also a meme to when this film will actually come out, because it's had a checkered history already into production. It's lost Danny Boyle as its director. Craig got injured. It's been a bit all over the show. I like the director they've got because I thought the first series of A True Detective was absolutely astounding. And I thought it was a beautiful looking cinematic TV series. Carrie Fujinawa?
Yeah, you know what? Apologies.
Carrie. I know you're a big listener and you'll be stopping production to listen to the Film File episode 2. But I'm a big fan of his work. I think it's an interesting choice. I thought Danny Boyle was an interesting choice. One of the things that I've been thinking about with the announcement of the new Bond film is the story that ran a couple of weeks ago. I think it was the Daily Mail ran it. So it must be true. It got picked up, and especially in the States, got picked up about this idea of a female 007 based on the fact that the fantastic writer of Fleabag, which is one of the best series ever, has come in to punch up the script. And it made me think about who they're going to choose, because the big question will always be, now Craig's going to say, this is it, who are they going to pick as the next Bond? And of course, all the arguments will come out. Is it going to be a female Bond, which I don't think will happen? Will it be a diverse cast? Will it have a diverse actor? And I was playing this conversation out in my head a little bit, because everyone's saying, well, Idris Elba would be a perfect. And I kind of felt myself falling into these two grounds of going, yes, it would be interesting to see somebody else play Bond. But do you remain true to what Fleming created? And I came down on the fact that I think you've got to stay true to who Fleming created. And I equate that, you know, with, you wouldn't want Daniel Craig playing Black Panther.
Yeah, I can see that. With the Bond thing, I mean, I know when there was the announcement that what's-her-name is going to be 007.
Yeah, which is perfectly within keeping that.
Everyone went crazy that a female is 007. How can a female be James Bond? Was that, well, she's not. She's no. got the agent 007 status because he's currently retired.
Yes, which he did at the end of Spectre, folks. Spoiler, he walked away at the end of Spectre. Drove away, in fact.
And I've got no qualms with there being another 007 where they can branch off and do whatever they want with. But yeah, I agree that the James Bond should be the James Bond of the books. I think Idris Elba would be a marvellous addition. Absolutely. And marvellous on screen, and he'd be front and centre throughout. Mm-hmm. Fantastic. I mean, he's probably the only good thing that there was in the Dark Tower film.
Yes, yeah. He's got, in Hobbs and Shaw, he's so charismatic, and when you're on screen with the two leads of that kind of heavy, big style, he holds his own. I think he would be an interesting... But would he be James Bond? It's an interesting fact. And you do find yourself going down these sort of alleyways of having to sort of justify it as well. Why a black actor can't play James Bond? And I have to keep coming back to, that's not how Fleming envisaged the character. I have no problems with recasting and diversifying other characters in other films. Perry White in Superman.
Yeah.
As Larry Fitchburn. So
if... Craig was definitely going to leave, because this is the last of his contracted ones. Unless he renews his contract, this is his last film. Mm. Anyone who you'd throw into the mix?
Yeah, instantly, I'd say Michael Fassbender.
Oh, interesting.
Ooh, I think he's got that style. And then what convinces me is in X-Men First Class, when he's right at the beginning, and it's set in the 60s, of course.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And he has that Connery-esque, he's got the hat on. And like Connery used to wear in the very first few, and I thought Fassbender would be. I don't know how old he is now. I don't know if he's coming up to his sort of 40s, which seems about the right age for Bond. He's got to be somebody. I'd hate to see Tom Holland pick it up, you know, and
like
and
James Bond Junior.
Yeah, James Bond Junior.
The '90s.
Yes, yeah. Where we go. Subject for another podcast where we do cult TV cartoons that you've forgotten. But yeah, I think Fassbender's got
I don't
that.
Think me or Scott have ever forgotten any of the cult cartoons.
Mr. T, anybody? But I think Fassbender's got that style. He looks like Bond. What's the film he did for Steven Soderbergh?
When he played...
the villain in it, yeah. And it was a spy movie. I can't.
I know exactly what you mean.
We'll come back to it. Ewan McGregor was in it. I think he's got that. People mentioned the guy out of Legion a few times.
Oh, Dan Stevens.
Dan Stevens, but he's just a little bit soft to me.
Great actor, but
he tends to play like jittery characters.
Yeah, he's got
a lot,
that twitchy edge.
I can't quite see a jittery Bond.
Like the voice he gives to the Beast in Beauty and the Beast is weirdly charming, though.
Yeah,
like, I could see him maybe flicking a switch.
Well, he is weirdly charming anyway.
Yeah, oh yeah, yeah. Of course.
I've been outed again.
and now he's getting a little bit older, and he's starting to show a little bit of wear and tear in a good way. Jamie Bell is an interesting choice.
Ooh.
And he got muted a few years back. But I thought he was too young. But now, you know, he's got to be his early 30s.
It's tough because similar to, like, say, when the Doctor's being cast in Doctor Who, you always go to people who seem so obviously like, yeah, they're next. Like Henry Cavill looks like he probably could play a Bond. But I quite like the slightly left of centre picks. Like
Daniel Craig was.
That's what
degree.
I mean, yeah. I would not have gone near him, but even just because he's blonde. But, like... At the time, you wouldn't have, would you? And then suddenly it's not an ish.
Well, a lot of people made it an ish.
Yes.
And the Blonde Not Bond website is still going.
Oh, is it? Are they still arguing?
Oh, they still want to rip everything apart, and they're not willing to accept that it's been a successful franchise.
It's been... this is the time, apart from the Connery era, and that I've collected these movies. I think he's been a fantastic Bond, and I'm very much looking forward to it.
And that's out April next year, I believe.
Mm.
Normally, the Bond films get dropped in late October, early November.
Yeah, usually a Christmas release, aren't
they? So it's going to be interesting. But with the absence of like a huge heavy hitter Marvel film next year, it leaves that window open, because the Marvel films next year, as we know, are a bit more low radar, newer characters.
Yeah.
Like they're not anticipating the billion sellers, but then again, pretty much
Guardians of the Galaxy.
Everything that they throw out is a billion at the moment.
Yeah.
But yeah, that gives a nice early summer slot to throw a Bond film into.
Interesting.
So from Bond to Matrix.
Yes, now this has come out a left hitter.
Scott brought this to my attention because he was following the news when he should have been working the other day.
Me never. well, it's just another part of the Reeves Renaissance, isn't it? Where we dredge up his back catalogue, and I can't wait to my own private Idaho too. It's going to be great.
Saw that coming?
I'm kind of psyched.
Yeah, I mean, there's been the rumours of like a spin-off for the Matrix franchise.
And a reboot.
A reinvigorating of it, drawing from, not completely retelling the story, but telling side stories or something. And it's just been bandied around for the past year. Nothing's been finalised until literally over the past few days, and all the casting is getting announced, and Lana Wachowski is back to direct.
Yeah.
Reeves and Moss are both back. Now, I think we're beyond spoiler alerts when it comes to the Matrix films. I mean, you know, Neo died at the end of the third film. However,
in a godlike way.
However, he died by becoming part of the computer system that ran the Matrix. So
I actually just want to stop you there. 1,000 points to you, Andy, for remembering what happens in the other two.
Oh, I love them.
Do you?
Oh,
I saw them with you, and I
looked I'm one of those people who, like, I can understand why people felt more and more alienated, but because I just embraced the fact that it was all anime philosophies being brought into live action entertainment, and I loved them. And I've watched them multiple times since, and yeah, I'm well up for the sequel to them. Loads of people have been speculating online saying, you know, we're working to go story-wise, because now that everyone knows that they're in Matrix, what's going to happen? Anyone who ever dabbled with the game Matrix Online knows exactly where they can go with the storylines, because that had 8 seasons, I think, of great stories set after the events of it. Put it this way, you know, everyone said, like, oh, once everyone knows what, like, that they're in the Matrix, surely everyone's going to be a superhero. Well, not everyone can tap into that, because you've got to leave the Matrix in order to understand the real world, to get back into the Matrix and then be able to override it. You need to be reprogrammed outside.
I think I'm in the Matrix right now.
So not everyone within the Matrix, even though they've been told that they are in the Matrix, will be a superhero. Those that want to leave the Matrix get to leave. But let's be honest, would you want to live in squalor and poverty, like eating gruel, outside the Matrix, or be happy it was touched upon in the first film, like, you know, the juicy steak. I know this isn't real. Mm. I know that this is just digital signals, but...
Hashtag, are we living in the Matrix?
I would stay in the Matrix, personally. I wouldn't want to even leave, even knowing that if I leave, I'd be able to get, like, little uploads into my brain to go back in and be even better than what I am. But, you know, I'm ace as it is.
We are on Twitter if you want to debate this issue. We are available for debate. But interesting, because you're right. I mean, we've got the new Bill and Ted... film coming out, which I love the Bill and Ted films, and I even, you know, people decry the second one, but it's as fresh as you can imagine. It's a very fresh film. So and Keanu Reeves just deserves all the plaudits and get for being the nicest guy apparently in show.
Genuinely
nice guy. And I'm looking forward to John Wick 4.
I'll hope that they also do a Speed 3 and bring him back to it and have it on Segways. I don't know.
Dracula 2.
Maybe that's the point.
Before we get to the really big news, let's just briefly touch on the sequel to Coming to America, which is called Coming to America.
I see what they did there.
Oh, must have took them ages to come up with that, about 3 minutes. Eddie Murphy's returning to the big screen, because what else has he got to do these days?
He's not even voicing Donkey right now, so no. he's
that's 5 minutes.
Eddie got away.
Yeah, gone.
Which apparently the storyline is that he's set to become king at last. However, he gets word that he's got a son in America that he didn't know about, And so as his father, James Earl Jones, like on his deathbed, says, "You must go over there and see your son and bring him into the family." That was a poor impression.
I never knew that James Earl Jones was Welsh. There we go.
And so he goes off to find his son. And no doubt, hilarity ensues. Pretty much the whole of the original cast are back. The big question with this is, did anyone actually really ask for a sequel to...
Well, it's a little bit like, it runs off the back of talking about The Matrix, and to some extent, Bill and Ted. There are a lot of sequels that studios must think are great ideas, but do we actually want them? You know, 20 years, however long it's been since, if not longer, 30 years since they're coming to America. Eddie Murphy's not a household name.
No.
Especially to a younger generation, and you guys know more than I do, sat in a cinema every day, seeing who comes through your door. It does warrant that there is always a sense with some of these sequels that do come out of nowhere. Is it a baby boomer generation executive who's gone, "I really love that movie and would love to see a sequel to it," rather than general public going, "I want to see a sequel to it."
How long is too long, though, to revisit?
Well, we'll know we're coming to America, too.
It's got to be there, hasn't it? I mean,
the latest news on it is the casting of a Tracy Morgan in it, and that's the point at which I was like, you know what, I don't want this film. I've got no time for him at all.
I don't mind. I was a big 30 Rock fan. So I'm interested to see. I've never seen him really do much else on the back end of 30 Rock.
What year was Coming to America again?
It was a 90s then. Film, wasn't it?
But we're talking 20 plus years now. Like, culture's changed.
Yeah, and generationally, there's an audience who may have seen it on TV or seen it on a streaming service.
But do you remember the weird uproar when Friends was uploaded to Netflix? I know a lot of the new generation watching it for the first time were criticising how unwoke it was. And it was like, well, yeah, it started in the mid-90s.
Yeah. It's a comedy series about rich white folks.
So obviously it's not
who
going
didn't
to
hang
be
around with any ethnics.
To today's standards of, like, you know, correctness. So surely that's an idea you'd rather revisit in a renewed cultural context than just go back to it and have it. I can't see it working at all.
Let us know what other interesting sequels that we don't want. You can reach us on Twitter. Twitter's any sequels that we don't want to see anymore. Yeah. I'll start it off with Trading Places 2.
At Filmfile UK is the Twitter handle if you want to go send us some feedback and some suggestions. And if we get some, we'll pick out some of the best
Schindler
ones for the next
list
show.
2, relisted.
Whoa!
And moving on.
I feel like part of my soul just withered and died at that statement.
So the bill won it.
Okay, so the big news this week,
which came out of nowhere, and I'm still sort of reeling from it because it doesn't feel like it's a legit. It's almost like a Trumpism. You know, it's something that, you know, let's buy a Greenland type story. Is there any basis in this? And apparently, it's no one saw this coming.
Marvel and Sony. Well, Disney and Sony have had a huge disagreement over the character of Spider-Man. Disney were reportedly wanting 50% of the takings on future films, and they've offered to put 50% of the budget into it in order to try to justify it. And Sony have basically turned around and gone, yeah, right, this is our character that we own that Marvel sold to us ages ago. Why should we give you half the money? And no longer is he going to be part of this.
They've literally taken their bat and ball home.
Yes. Scott, your thoughts on this?
It's tough because you can see both sides, can't you? Because from Disney's perspective, Sony are fronting the money, but that Disney are outright producing it, letting Kevin Feige spend all his time and whatever on it when he could be making the new X-Men, and which Disney profit all of it. But by the same token, Sony are sort of slow losing Spider-Man through the back door and going, that's not okay.
The only people who are going to lose out are us, the viewers and the fans, really. I did see, I think it was on bleedingcool.com, about, you know, a welcome back to the lousy Spider-Man movies. But, you know, out of the five that they produced, one of them is still one of the best superhero movies ever, and is Spider-Man 2.
Yeah.
And that was guided through by Sony. I'm hoping that some, it's still early days, there still could be a resolution. I don't know if there will be, of course not, it's pure speculation. It would be nicer that they can resolve it, because as I say, ultimately we lose out. We want Spider-Man to be part of the Marvel Universe as fans and as moviegoers, and what we've been led to believe. The quality that the Marvel Studios have brought to, I've not got the hate on the Andrew Garfield series at all that a lot of people have. I think the first film was quite an interesting film, Amazing Spider-Man 2.
I feel that the first Amazing Spider-Man film is a better origin film than Sam Raimi's first Spider-Man film.
Agreed. Controversially agreed.
Yes, hashtag controversial. but I think there's a lot to it, and my thoughts changed on it. I saw something on YouTube about it, that it was more of an evolution of someone who wanted to be a hero than becoming a hero straight away, that the Raimi film did. And that sort of realistic tone that they brought to it, I've got a real soft spot for it. But, you know, Spider-Man 2 is up there with, I think, Superman as being one of the godfathers of the superhero genre. The two current Spider-Man films that are running, I think Tom Holland is the perfect Spider-Man. But I think it lacks the gravitas that Spider-Man, Sam Raimi film, and certainly Spider-Man 2 brought to it, that it meant something. And I don't think these two have. They felt frivolous.
Yeah, it's just the point we're at with the... with the second film, it just leads itself to what happens next. Mm. And then Sony definitely can't tackle it, because you'll spend the whole time going, where are all these allies he's accumulated that we're not referencing? And then the MCU obviously can't attack it because they've lost him. So you're almost forced to quietly soft reboot over to the side. And it's the timing I don't like the most. But I've got a free pitch for Sony.
Okay.
Okay.
Because
we know that Sony listen.
Oh, yeah. The Spider-Verse film, which is proof Fox can make a good Spider-Man film.
Sony, that
weird studio dysplasia. Sony can make a good Spider-Man film. Live-action version, get Tobey Maguire back, get Andrew Garfield back, get Tom Holland in, never reference the universes, have them play off each other, and a Miles Morales, Donald Glover, anyone. And everyone will be too busy fangasming.
Yeah.
Distracted.
Yeah, but that would also work in the storyline's favour, in that, you know, it gets out of this, like, you know, Peter Parker's identity has just been revealed to the world aspect. Hang on, there's Spider-Man, there's Peter Parker. And it using a multiverse aspect would be a way that they could kind of soft reboot it and move it out of the MCU and into its own universe. I mean, you say about, like, you know, they wouldn't be able to draw upon, like, all the friends that he's made. How many did you draw on in Far From Home?
Yeah, I mean, it's...
And it's the same with any of the standard MCU characters. Whenever they've got the solo outing, very rarely do they actually... You always wonder, like, so why didn't they just call on Thor? Why are the rest of the Avengers not helping here? Why is this person on their own? So I don't think that's actually an issue. Because all that we had in Far From Home to link us to the MCU was in whining about, like, Mr. Stark every 5 minutes. And Nick Fury.
I've got two words of advice, and I know they signed a deal with somebody, and I don't know who it is. I can't remember off the top of my head. Miller and Lord, put Miller and Lord in.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
In front of the Spider-Man
and have
franchise.
Confidence in them. Don't do what Disney did with Star Wars.
I think our greatest fear, though, I feel, is this will be a green light for Sony to go, well, we can put him in the Venom film and run away with Mobius.
I don't think Tom Holland's Spider-Man fits with the direction that Venom's taken.
News on that, but actually, is Andy Serkis has signed on to direct the...
Which is interesting.
Which is an interesting choice. And you might feel that that's definitely a lead actor pushing in that direction for that one.
On the positive side, if they don't resolve all these... details and they don't come with a 70-30 in the end or something like that, and he's left the MCU. On a personal level, I'm happier, because that will mean that he won't be able to use an Iron Spider suit, which is relying on the tech far too much. I mean, what I've always loved about the character of Spider-Man is that when he needs more strength, he finds it from within himself with his own powers and his own motivations. It's not just his suit goes...
Which they did at the end of Homecoming.
Enhancing power. Entering kill mode, which has been very controversial from the end game scene. It's like, kill mode doesn't mean that he's killed everyone. It's just the overpower mode. But the suit does too much for him.
Yes.
I want his powers to do things. If he's in the dark, I don't want his night vision to come on. We finally got to see it in Far From Home where he started to use his spider sense, although they were calling it the Petey Tingle. I want to see his powers evolve without the need for an Iron Man suit. I don't want him to be a second-rate Iron Man because that's what Dan Slott did with him in the comics in recent years. And thankfully, Slott's moved on to other things. More on that later. final news. Final news. Scorsese's The Irishman. Who's excited?
Very much so. I saw the trailer for it when they premiered that. It felt like a Scorsese film that we've not seen since Casino. It felt comfortable, confident. He is De Niro's best director. They work together very well. They solidified their careers together. Both of them done their best work together. Great to see them back. It looked like everything I like about a Scorsese film when he's in that particular genre. I've not been a big fan of some of the things that Scorsese's done over the last few years. I know he's moving on as a filmmaker. That's interesting. But I'm just glad to see him back in territory. And it's, interestingly enough, and I know you're going to pick up on this, it's gone straight to Netflix.
Yeah.
However.
It's a Netflix production. So as always, it'll be going to the service. However, it's such a production and such great names in there. Loads of prestige around it. Obviously, they're going to do the usual like limited release so they can get nominations for Oscars. There's a lot of rumblings going on that it's going to be more than just a limited release. It won't be like a 3-month... Most cinemas ask that there's a 3-month window before it goes onto home media because they want to be able to get like at least 12 weeks if it sells well and keep it running. So whenever they've done these like small, like straight-to-DVD or straight-to-streaming service releases, they've just sought out a few small independent cinemas just to get a 2-week run. Done. You can now get nominated. There's rumblings that they're looking for a longer one, so maybe 4-week release, and they're in talks with the smaller chains. Apparently AMC in the US are in talks, and they're in talks with chains in the UK and also in Europe to release it for a limited run through them. Now, I can't confirm or deny the information, but I can tell you that there's definitely been communications going to cinemas asking to test to see if they can play the Netflix content, that they need to have the right frame rate, and there's little test packages being sent out. There's email communications going backwards and forwards. Whether this is for The Irishman, no one knows. But I can confirm that those communications are going out at the moment, that Netflix is trying to get into cinemas.
As Netflix has changed how we all view and how we expect new releases, and of course how new releases have changed, the very nature of independent cinema is moving away from independent cinemas and moving straight to Netflix. A film like The Irishman 10, 15 years ago would have been a big release with the weight of having Scorsese on as a director alone would have given it a box office credence. I find it bizarre that this film couldn't have been made for a major studio for a cinema release. But if it's the way we get to see it, I would certainly like to see it in the cinema before being able to watch it on Netflix.
I mean, I can kind of understand they want to go a bit bigger with this release because on the back of Roma last year, and there was all the like hoo-ha when that was like in the Oscars and like a prime candidate for like major awards. Like, I mean, Spielberg was campaigning like this shouldn't be there because it's a TV movie. But it wasn't.
Did you see Roma?
I never got round to it, no, but I don't agree with Spielberg. I think it's one foot in the past, sort of scared of change, sort of.
Yeah, I totally agree.
Shouting at the cloud sort of comment, isn't it?
But it feels that like Netflix are now trying to go, well, okay, when we've got something which is like more worthy, can we manage to get a more wider release?
It's a prestigious
The major film. Chains will still turn it down because if it's only going to be 4 weeks, they don't want it. Yeah. They won't touch it. But it gives the smaller chains a chance to go, you know what, we've got exclusives on something.
Yeah.
And it's an exciting time if you work within a smaller chain. It's a very exciting time.
Well, it's like all media. It's becoming more niche and fragmented. So it's about exploring those rivers, isn't it, and getting the best out of your product. So if that's got the best of both worlds there, hasn't it? Because everyone sees it mainstream-wise on Netflix. Your more film-goers, purists, will go to the independent chains. Everyone wins every step of the way. And it should be nominated. It's just as valid a piece of art, good or bad.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I don't get the just because someone chucked it up on a big screen, it's more valid than a small screen. No. I never have.
It's a beast of a thousand nations.
The same effort went into the making of the film, regardless of what the distribution was. Roma is the great example. That is one of the most luscious looking films of that I've seen.
And a cinematic director.
It's a beautiful film, beautiful story. It deserved every plaudit that it got. Yeah.
And deserved to be seen. And I think the problem we've got, I mean, our love of a specific genre has to some extent squeezed out a lot of the smaller films. Mm-hmm. Films that, we're an ever-changing audience. And films like the Scorsese film, which, as I said earlier, would have had that prestige on the cinema, are finding an audience where people can stay at home and watch it and not see it in a cinema. Right or wrong, that's just the way that it's gone. But it doesn't make it less worthy. I'm just going to add one final, I know we said we're going to move on, but I've just noticed that the Joker film is coming out with a hard R rating in the US. So I don't know, what does that mean over here?
18, possibly.
18.
It could get a 15, a strong 15, but it's likely to be an 18.
Thoughts on this? It's getting a lot of interesting feedback.
I'll pass this over to our DC experts.
Joaquin Phoenix playing a version of the DC character, the Joker. Not the Joker, not a Joker, a version of the Joker. I think we said off air, a little bit like an Elseworlds sort of variational take on it. So it's not fitting within the DC universe, whatever that means now. Robert De Niro is part of it. I think Scorsese is involved in it. Todd Phillips is directing. The trailer looked very, very gritty. Had an almost sort of Goodfellas Mean Streets sort of vibe coming off of it. But it looks like it's going for, the full impact of being a very, very dark story.
It's got me very conflicted because he's not a small character, is he? He's in every house. Everyone knows Heath Ledger and everyone's got their own preconceived notions of how it should be done. So obviously making a film of it is a no-brainer. But the way they've done it is so left field. But that's what kind of excites me. If you were a studio sitting on that property, why on earth would you go in this direction? Unless you got a pitch that was so, my God, I have to do this. So I think it's going to be very reminiscent of Scorsese's Mean Streets meets Taxi Driver.
Meets King of Comedy.
That great show, actually, yeah. And just push it through that end. And obviously that might upset a few fanboys here and there, want to see him fall in some chemicals and Batman come and punch him and whatever. But if you're going to explore him in isolation, because he is just an agent of chaos who works sort of opposed to Batman, if you have to sort of dissect him, you want to do it in an Elseworlds, take him out of the comics and put him somewhere in a different genre that will interest you. And I think they've picked the most fascinating one for that, in a weird way.
They're already...
you've sold me.
Yeah.
You've sold me in a way that I hadn't been sold on it before, which is, as you just said, is if this is such a good pitch, then why not do this film?
Yeah.
We've got that amount of talent. And I've always thought with Todd Phillips, he was almost too, especially with the Hangover series, he was too cinematic for comedy.
Yeah.
And I think comedy, for me, always feels though it should have a more realistic look. And the Hangover films, as they progressed and he became more confident as a filmmaker, I think, they became very, very cinematic. And I think he's an interesting choice of director for this. And if you get somebody like Scorsese interested in being having a producer title on it and therefore getting De Niro in it, there must be something within this film. And the reviews or the word on it has been very, very positive. But I don't think you go and see it as a DC character. No, I think you see it in its own light. Of the Joker's always been one of these characters that there's never been one origin for him. There's been half a dozen, the Michael Keaton version had him as a very, very different Joker, the Jack Napier character. That's never been canon. There's been various different variations within the series. The way that they did it in Dark Knight, that he could have had multiple origins. That's how the Joker should be. You could have another Joker in a Batman film. with a completely different origin, and it wouldn't feel out of place.
I'm hoping it opens some doors in terms of, because there's a lot of uncertainty with the universe, which is why I think a lot of people are uneasy about a different Joker film just being chucked out there in isolation. But like, if this is a hit, it makes studios go, not everything has to be in-universe reference X, Y, and Z and Cell Z. Just take a character, because they're all really incredibly malleable and adaptable, which is why they're all thriving so much and rebooted so often. It just opens so many new doors where we could get that 30s Batman noirish take. People can experiment a bit and just throw an Elseworlds label and just go, this is onto itself. And we could get some cooler stuff.
That's the route that DC should take.
I love the idea of an Elseworlds kind of approach for DC, because let's be honest, trying to world build and bring them all together, they're always going to get compared to Marvel. Mm. And if they don't do the bank that Marvel does, they'll get criticised, as they have done. They will then panic and start make bad decisions, and they'll meddle with the creative like stylings of it. I mean, as much as Zack Snyder, I didn't appreciate what he was doing with Man of Steel, I do think it's a shame that the studio lost faith in him straight after Man of Steel and started pressuring him to do different things, because you can see how he probably did have a vision. He probably had a great, like, you know, 5 or 6 film vision to lead up to a finale, but it got all condensed. Batman was quickly, hurriedly put into it, etc., because the studio panicked. An Elseworlds kind of approach means that they don't have to panic, because every film's its own film.
Yes.
You don't have to worry about linking it to that, and now you've got to build that story. It's like, no, that story's its own thing. If that didn't work, that's fine, because the next one's its own thing. DC should just go for that.
Yeah,
and then absolutely. If you want to fold them all together, do a crisis movie and bring them all onto the same planet.
I mean, it's all sorts of ways. But then you don't have to worry about how Matt Reeves' Batman affects Shazam, which affects Aquaman, which affects and then you create all this
head in their own right.
Yeah, you just go, take each movie as it comes, like we used to do.
Yeah.
Marvel
have created something that's unique. Let that be Marvel's. DC should just do something that's unique for them. Mm. And they could bring a Scorsese. They could bring a different director in that doesn't feel... I mean, Marvel has very much a house style with how their films look. They're very colourful, very bright-looking films. Fantastic. We're living in a golden age where these films can happen. But... you know, Richard Donner's Superman is still at the highest level for me.
Exactly. Dark Knight for myself.
It didn't need a connected universe to make it a fantastic film.
Steel is mine.
Catwoman.
Again, contact Andy via Twitter.
But if you can't beat Marvel as a collective, so beat them individually by just producing good films.
About your great characters.
Yeah.
And use the whole pantheon of characters. Stop relying on Batman all the time. Hmm. Yeah. Let's see Plastic Man on the screen.
Yes.
Who was it who I suggested for Plastic Man the other day?
Oh, it was, I was saying, if Joel Schumacher had to...
it had to direct like a DC film again, which would you choose? Plastic Man.
Okay. Let's move on now to our feature review. New Quentin Tarantino film out in the cinemas right now, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
I'm Rick Dalton.
That's your son?
No, that's my stunt double, Cliff Booth.
I'm Sharon Tate. I'm in the movie.
Cool.
That was the best acting I've ever seen.
Welcome to our community.
Charlie's gonna dig you.
That can all change back then.
I love that stuff, you know, the killing.
A lot of killing.
Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
I'm gonna be very clear. I've just come back from a lovely 2-week holiday. I'm very brown. It's a shame you can't see the tan lines, but I've not had a chance to see this. Scott, I believe you've not had a chance to see this.
I don't have quite the excuses you do, and still haven't seen it.
And so I'm gonna push it over to Andy, who has seen it. And what we thought we'd do is Andy talks about the film. We can also talk, and Scott and I can throw in about Tarantino as a filmmaker and where he's going, and he's put himself up for talking about retirement and moving away from it. He's still got a Star Trek movie to write before he goes for me. Tell us about it.
Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. This is Tarantino's love letter to the era of film that influenced him. There's little elements throughout it that you just go, that's why he's obsessed with martial arts. That's why, because it's set at that end of the golden era of cinema. DiCaprio's playing Rick Dalton, a once respected star who's now consigned to guest appearances, usually as the villain or the heavy, who gets killed off because that's his declining career. His stunt double with a sketchy past is played by Brad Pitt, and that's Cliff Booth. And they are the prime focus of the story, as it, the story follows Rick's attempt to become a name again. In the backdrop of that, there's the day in the life aspect of Sharon Tate, played by marvellously by Margot Robbie, who is Rick's next door neighbour that he just can't find the courage to go and get acquainted with, her and her husband, Roman Polanski. Now, many mistakenly believe when this film was getting pitched and like sold that the film would be about Tate and the Manson family murders. But no, that's never been Tarantino's intention. It's always been to use that as the backdrop to tell a story and just have this fantasy version of Sharon Tate, like, in the background of it, throughout it. To say more on this would be spoilerific, so I'm very cautious not to spoil things here, because the way that the story all plays out is beautifully structured. It uses Tarantino's little, like, flashbacks and forwards, which, for the first 20 minutes, because he's not really done this for the past couple of films, when he's suddenly thrown himself back to, like, the, okay, we'll jump back and forwards like he did on Reservoir Dogs.
Pulp Fiction.
It's a bit jarring, but then you start to get to work out, oh, yeah, this was 3 days earlier. Oh, now we're back to the real time, et cetera, et cetera. It's basically every time that someone has a little memory of something, it's like a Family Guy cutaway. except without Peter saying something daft. Suffice to say on this one that when Tarantino dismissed that one very carefully constructed attack on his representation of women with an "I reject your hypothesis," having watched the film, I completely understand why he rejected that hypothesis. The much publicised low word count that Robbie has, I don't know why I did the speech marks, because the guys who were listening can't actually hear me do the speech marks.
He did, we can confirm.
It's actually part of the whole point of her character being here. We lowly cinema patrons who watched the big screen, we're watching Rick Dalton and thinking, wow, an actor at the end of his career. Oh, well, how are we supposed to feel sorry for him? Because, you know, he's had his great moments and all that. But she's supposed to be the character that people like Rick Dalton aspire to be. And so she's his mythical creature to, like, oh, I could probably boost my career if I could just be a part of their circle. Everyone has that little bit level ahead. And so her day in the life is to show her doing a normal things, because she's a fantasy character. We don't need to see her interact with the story. We don't need to see her, like, meddle with things. She's not a provocateur. She's just there to showcase that actors and actresses were normal people as well.
And this was an interesting time in Hollywood. And I can see why Tarantino, as you said earlier, it's that moment of where Hollywood became something different. We were on the verge of the end of the Summer of Love down to the Manson killings was instrumental in sort of ending that hippie age. Not long afterwards, we got Roman Polanski, you know, doing, you know, Rosemary's Baby. Around that time. You got Easy Rider coming through, which changed how young people were seeing that. And my belief is, from what I've read, if I'm wrong, I apologise, but the characters are supposed to be Burt Reynolds and Hal Needham, sort of in to a degree. And Burt Reynolds reinvented himself from he was in a series called Cheyenne, I believe.
Yeah.
And then Deliverance, again, which was almost a slightly counterculture thriller, gave him the resurgence. He was third on the bill, even though he'd had this TV history, and people like Steve McQueen were moving out into sort of doing more experimental films like the original Thomas Crown Affair. So it was a period in Hollywood where the old guard was certainly changing, and the Manson killings as a shadow of that were one of the great, you know, people still talk about it now, clearly. There's a couple of other films, the Manson films in production right now, some of them ready for release. Matt Smith playing Charles Manson in one film, I've noticed. It still holds a shadow to how that particular period and that age changed tremendously.
Yeah, I mean, you know, that the whole aspect of Rick's character being like a once big screen star who's done a TV series for 5 or 6 years and now gone into decline, you know, it does, like, link back to, like, the age of the, like, the big names were the names on screen. But then you got to the end of the 60s and into the 70s, it was less about the big names on screens, it was more about just individual films, and, like, there was no real big stars.
Yeah, the star system had started to break apart.
And that's what Tarantino was analysing here. Look back on Tarantino's career, look on all his films, and you can see influences on each one of them, like where he's drawn things from like Chinese cinema, from Hong Kong action films, from like your Hollywood blockbusters of like the 60s and early 70s, etc. And this is the film where he really expresses his love. It's beautifully framed, beautifully shot. He really loves the whole industry that he set it around. His obsession with feet has to be brought up, because this film, more than any of his films, has a lot of feet in it.
Oh, he's doubled down.
Oh, wow. he's gone crazy with the foot fetish. I mean, I recently rewatched all of his films, including like the ones that he just like wrote, like True Romance, etc., yeah. And also the ones that he was just like producer of or participated in. And while watching through them, seeing like how his obsession with feet got more and more through it.
There's a 2-minute sequence in Kill Bill, for instance.
This film has more feet than I ever needed to see in a 2.5-hour period. I'd say that this is a strong recommendation, because I'd say that this is his strongest film since Pulp Fiction.
That's good to know. I fell off the Tarantino bandwagon. I think he's an interesting filmmaker. He's always got an interesting voice. I think he became too Tarantino with Bastards. I thought it was, he almost homaged himself to that degree. It wasn't the film that I went in to see, so I think maybe that was part of it. I thought it was going to be a Man on a Mission film, and it really isn't. And I thought, you know, scenes of big dialogue scenes were just, it's a bit like J.K. Rowling. Stay with me, guys. J.K. Rowling, when she had an editor who could tell her, no, don't write this, and keep it lean, kept the stories tighter. When she was allowed to, when she had a huge international success, she could write whatever she wanted and no one would tell her. Stephen King had the same thing.
I completely agree. It's overindulgent.
Yeah, and somebody wasn't around to tell Tarantino. Yeah.
You're wonderfully loquacious, mate. Great scene.
But you don't need Mike Myers turning up as a weird British general.
But ten more minutes have passed since this scene could have ended.
Yeah, the whole scene in Inglourious Basterds of the game in the cellar in the German bar didn't progress the story.
It's almost like a collection of short films that happen to be sequential, isn't it?
On that cellar scene, having recently rewatched it, I have to disagree.
You see, I recently rewatched it and I disagree. Where does that leave us? It's sort of in the Matrix.
I didn't get it first time round, but when I watched it recently, I was drawn into that scene. It was the tension building of that scene. I just think it was the rest of the like film had been bogged down by unnecessary sides, which maybe by the point of getting to that scene, it was like, oh, really? Just hurry it up now. And that might be why it didn't quite impact. But for me, that was the strongest scene aside from the opening farmhouse scene, which I think is the most intense like dialogue exchange that I've ever seen like on any Tarantino film.
That was pure threat. You see, and I didn't get to see Hateful Eight, and I just wasn't drawn to it. I'd like to have seen the 70mm print of it, which was going around, and unfortunately missed that, but wasn't drawn to Hateful Eight. Basically, after Inglourious Basterds, I just...
It's tough, because if you had to rank just pure gold Tarantino scenes, they'd all be up there and you'd think, oh, that must be one of his best films. But if I had to rate his films, I'd put it quite low down.
Do you do that with Tarantino? Do you rate scenes rather than you rate movies? Do you go, the scene out of such and such was, you know, fantastic?
There is a degree of that. I think even with like Kill Bill and stuff,
your mind moments dwells rather than overall.
See, Kill Bill Volume 1 was more of a complete film for me than Volume 2.
Yeah.
Because it went down several rabbit holes of areas that we didn't need. I don't think you needed the whole flashback training sequences to last as long as it did. But he's an interesting voice. And I think you can always come back to, he's a cinema voice. And it sounds from what you've just said, Andy, that it keeps bringing it back to, it's a love of cinema every time. That's the guiding principle of all films. They are relatable. They come from somewhere that we recognise. Yeah. And he puts his own touch on it. I do know that he did have I shall name drop. I am slight friends with Russell Mackay, the film director. And I do know that at one point there was a vampire script going around that Russell Mackay was looking at. That was a Tarantino one. And I think it was called 8 Weeks, if I remember correctly, which would have been interesting. But if he does decide to retire, it'd be interesting to see what he does next. I would like him certainly to finish this Star Trek script, because it would be nice to have that cast come back and do one last film together.
It'd be weird to retire on a Star Trek film, though, wouldn't it? Because he's always stuck by this 10-film.
I think his 10-film thing is 10 films are the things that are his kind of idea and property. But he's also backtracked recently. I mean, I picked this up on an interview when he was saying, like, he considers Kill Bill 1 and 2 as being, like, one film.
Yeah.
Okay, so we're not on the 9th film, we're on the 8th film. And he said, like, he's got an idea for a Kill Bill 3. So that would be part of that one film.
Yeah.
Okay, so that'll be... And I think he's going to use little get-out-of-jail clauses there. And then he'll turn around and say, well, Jackie Brown was adapted from another story. Someone else came up with that story. So that's not one of my films. He will make films as long as he's got an idea. He's not rushing to make films. He's set himself this ambiguous 10 films idea. That's purely down to he can see the decline in the use of actual film stock in the industry. And he doesn't want to make films if he can't use film stock. He hates digital. He doesn't want to do it. And I think that's when he came out with his 10 films thing. He just basically said, well, there's only about another 5 or 6 years of like this going on. So that should cover me until then.
So we won't see his films on Netflix? As in film, who knows?
You'll see them on Netflix, but he has to have shot them in actual 35mm or 70mm stock.
I think for a genuinely superstar household name director, I think a studio would let him film however he wanted, regardless of what the going standard is. So I don't know why he's...
Steven Soderbergh came back, has had more comebacks now than Captain Scarlet. So,
if he stops making films, I would love him to continue writing and maybe produce TV series. I think a Tarantino verse series exploring different eras has so much potential.
Interesting.
Well, that takes us around to our wrapping it up, really. And I just want to go around the table, and we're going to do this every episode now. Something neat that you've either seen, watched, ate, podcasted, or just thoroughly enjoyed. Andy, anything for us?
Well, at the moment, I'm going through a bit of a Douglas Adams phase.
Nothing wrong with that, sir. 42 is the answer.
There was the recent news of a new TV adaptation of Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, which got me all excited. And so I went and listened to the radio drama and then read the book again and then watched the movie. And then ordered the BBC TV series triple box set, working through all the extras. And I am in love with Douglas Adams' work again. Oh, absolutely marvellous. And I can't wait to see this new TV series. But in the meantime, I've just finished Restaurants at the End of the Universe, the book. So I'm now on to Life, the Universe and Everything. And then it's So Long and Thanks for All the Fish and Mostly Harmless. I still don't know whether I'm going to go for that fifth book that wasn't written by him.
Was it canon?
Sixth book. It's canon, but I just don't feel it.
I actually met Douglas Adams once.
Oh.
A long, long time ago. And I made a complete arse of myself. A story for another time.
I did that with Terry Pratchett. And another thing that I just want to mention is it's been going for a good few months now, but I have to extol the virtues of Dan Slott's writing on the Fantastic Four comic at the moment.
It's great.
It's fantastic.
Yes.
I was well known for being vocal about my hatred of Dan Slott when he was covering Spider-Man, and Dan Slott blocked me on Twitter when I dared to complain that his stories like weren't quite doing it for me. Didn't even link him in. So he searched for his name and then just blocked me on Twitter. Wow. However, when he took Fantastic Four, I was initially like, oh no, don't ruin that as well, because Fantastic Four was my first Marvel love, first comics, loved them. Always been with me ever since. It appears that Dan Slott was introduced to like comic books via Fantastic Four as well. And you can tell he loves these characters.
There's a real family aspect
to
it again.
He's got the family, he's got the jokey nature, the light humour, but the drama and the cosmic scale. And it's just fun. It's exactly what Fantastic Four should be. It's that family unit in weird, bizarre settings. And we finally got to see Ben and Alicia get married.
Yeah, it has been. It's been a really cool run.
Oh!
And lovely art as well on it. Scott, anything for us? Anything neat?
I've been watching Harmon Quest, which is Dan Harmon of Community and Rick and Morty fame. It's kind of a spin-off of his Harmon Town podcast, where he found a guy called Spencer Crittington, I believe. Forgive me if I butchered his name. where the... committed about half an hour to an hour at the end of each podcast to play Dungeons and Dragons. So they've done a spin-off where they play something that's very similar to Dungeons and Dragons, but isn't Dungeons and Dragons, wink, wink, copyright. and then it's sort of animated over. So it's like improv comedy playing Dungeons and Dragons with animation of their hijinks and adventures. It was really fun. I quite enjoy it. It's
where can we find it?
it's on I believe it's called VRV in America. I've been finding it on this very legal cartoon website.
We'll move on from that, just in case.
I don't know where it's available in England, but I think it will be soon.
Series of Rick and Morty due.
Yes, season four. Very, very, very.
And I watched Monster House again. I watched it with my son.
It's really good.
And it's really good. I didn't realise that Dan Hartman had written it.
No, I realised that.
And now I know he wrote it.
I can see it.
I can see it all over. Yeah, it's a great little gag.
It's funny what gets past your peripheries sometimes, isn't it?
As I just said, I've been on holiday. I had 2 weeks in the sun and I decided that I was going to have a talking book so I could sit around the pool drinking cocktails and rather than read. Listen to a talking book, and this ties into probably our next episode. So Audacity, which is the Amazon version of the talking book. Audible. Audacity is a... we'll cut that. Just cut that. I won't even go with that. So Audible, it's on Audible, and I listened to it, Stephen King reading, by an American comedy actor called Steve Weber. Steve Weber used to be in a series called Wings. He played Jack Torrance in Stephen King's version of The Shining for American TV. He's a good actor, but his reading of it is absolutely phenomenal. Every time he opens his mouth in a different character, you hear a different character here. His playing of Pennywise is amazing. It's so beautifully read. And what I did notice that I didn't get when I was reading it, I think I stopped reading it about halfway through, is how beautifully written that book is. Stephen King's prose, for everything that we throw at Stephen King for slightly being overindulgent with his storytelling, he is a master of prose, beautifully, beautifully written, and that really came through.
It's marvellously structured as well, doing the like backwards and forwards in time aspect. I mean, I know the film has adapted it in a different manner, and I think it works for the two
parts
of the
film. For the linear version, yeah.
But in the book, it's that jumping to them as adults and then going back to the people that... elements that defined where those adults are.
Absolutely.
In their lives, backwards and forwards. Marvellous structure.
And it's so well read that you get a sense of time, literally, by the actor changing his voice. And I'd like to hear him read more, especially more Stephen King. That's it for this episode. We'll be back in a couple of weeks. We hopefully will be talking about It, Chapter 2. It's been a pleasure. You can find us on...
Twitter, at FilmFileUK. You can also find this podcast on SoundCloud, iTunes, and Spotify. And eventually, once we get it in the UK, Google Podcasts.
You can't wait. You can't buy this sort of entertainment.
And we're not even charging you for it. I mean, this is just generous.
We're not.
I was brought to you under false pretenses.
We'll see you again very, very soon.